So today we're going to look at the tantras and Shaivism. And we're going to follow Alexis's and Exisalvason's historical mapping of the traditions that he's presented in various publications, which I'd urge you to read. The earliest is beyond the bibliography, is in The World's Religions, as a long time ago now, 1988. And the latest mapping, it hasn't really changed very much, but he's filled up the details. It's in Shaiva Exegesis, in a volume published from the Centre of Indology in Pondicherry, edited by Dominic Goodall, on Shaivism. So that's it's a 130-page article, so it's well worth reading. Now, traditions whose focus is Shiva, the teachings of Shiva, the Shiva Shastra, and or his consort, the goddess Shakti, are known as Shaivism. Shaivism refers to the religions of Shiva. And Shiva occurs pretty early on in the tradition. He takes a form of Rudra in the Vedas, who's a fairly ferocious deity who's on the edges of Vedic society. And his Rudra means the roarer, he roars. And it describes him as one of the hymns to Rudra as it wants to keep, it prays to Rudra to keep away from our children, and keep away from our cattle, just leave us alone. And he's got a red back and a big belly and a tail, and he's a very horrendous looking figure. So he's a distant, ferocious deity in the Upanishad, in the Vedas. And then by the time we get to the Upanishads, he's obviously grown during this period. And the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, which is composed probably about 200 BC, it has Rudra, and identifies Rudra with the deity Shiva. Now Shiva means the auspicious one. So Rudra and Shiva become identified by this period. And in the Shvetashvatara, Rudra, Shiva, is the supreme deity. He's the Shvetashvatara. It's a bit like the Bhagavad Gita, I suppose, in a way, for the Shaivas. But it's probably composed about the same period. And it's a theistic Upanishad devoted to Shiva, who also known as Rudra, who's been stripped of these more horrific aspects and is the lord of the universe, the creator, the maintainer, and the destroyer of the universe. And then developing on, and by the medieval period, we get the Puranas, which we've looked at with regard to the Vaishnava tradition. You get the same with the Shiva tradition. You get these Shaiva Puranas and the orthodox worship of Shiva in groups called the Smarta Brahmins, those who follow the Smritis, those who follow the traditions. And there's a big, a lot of Puranic Shaivism. There's a Shiva Purana, the Linga Purana, which is orthodox worship of Shiva, orthodox puja to Shiva. And when these people were called Maheshwaras, and when these Maheshwaras died, they went to the Shiva Loka. They got reborn in the Shiva Loka. As the Vaishnavas got reborn in Vaikuntha, so the Shaivas got reborn in Shiva Loka, at the top of the world egg. And this was orthodox Smarta Shaivism. They also followed texts followed from the Smritis, Dharma, Shiva Dharma texts, which have only just recently come to light. We didn't know about these texts before the last 10-15 years. And Alexis Sanderson working on them and showing how these Shiva Dharma texts were very important in medieval kingdoms. Kingship was linked in with these texts on Shiva Dharma. Again, following the Smritis, Smarta Brahman, Smarta Brahmanical Shaivism, very orthodox, very puritanical, giving vegetarian worship to Shiva as the Shiva Linga. Now, on the other hand, you get what might be called non-Puranic Shaivism, which is a different kind of Shaivism, which assumes the Puranic Shaivism, but says actually we go further than the Puranic Shaivism, the orthodox worship of Shiva. We have liberation, we have a higher goal, a higher purpose in life. And to undergo this kind of Shaivism, you had to undergo initiation, diksha. So diksha is a Shaiva practice, which then enters into Buddhism and enters into Vaishnavism as well. But it originates, possibly modelled on the consecration of the king in Shaivism. Now within this non-Puranic Shaivism, which entailed initiation or diksha, in which you got a new name and you followed a certain kind of prescribed teachings thereafter, supererogatory rituals, is divided into two groups. One was called the Ati Marga, and one was called the Mantra Marga. Now the Ati Marga means the higher path or the outer path, and it was the path of those who followed a path leading to liberation, which they thought was the fifth ashrama. You've heard of the four stages of life. This was the fifth stage of life, the Ati Marga, the path beyond the orthodox four stages. So you know, we go higher than that lot. They just got renunciation. We've got something beyond that, the Ati Marga. I'm from about the 2nd century CE, and these groups were called Pashupatas. And Pashupati is the name of Shiva, the lord of the animals, the lord of the beasts, Pashupati. So these are the Pashupatas, those who follow Pashupati.
You said Pashupati is... What is Pashupati?
Oh, it's a name for Shiva.
Name for Shiva.
Yeah, and it means the lord of the beasts, the lord of the animals. Lord of the Pashus. And these groups, they were ascetics, and they became very important and very powerful in medieval India, and they owned lots of land. So Somnath in Mamila Thapa has written about was owned by the Pashupatas. And it's like all monastic institutions, they became very wealthy, so they got targeted by various political groups, by kings and so on, and their wealth got raided. It happened in the Reformation, didn't it? The monasteries get wealthy and then they get attacked by the kings. So likewise with the Pashupatas, because they're ascetics, they don't need anything, but they get lots of wealth building up in the monasteries. So a very powerful group in medieval India. And their doctrines, again, you had to be initiated into the Pashupata system. Male ascetics. And there's a text called the Pashupata Sutras of Kaundinya, which is before the 10th century. But it's very difficult to date. And their hero, their founder, is Lakulisha, the lord of the club, of the stick, the Lakulisha, who was a form of Shiva, really, who entered into the body of a dead Brahmin in order to teach the teachings of Shiva. So he reanimated this Brahmin's body and taught. There are various other myths of Lakulisha, but whether he's a historical figure is impossible to say, but he's a mythical figure who's said to have founded the Pashupata tradition. And there were different groups, different Pashupata traditions. One of the groups was called the Lakulishas. But anyway, all of these groups shared this idea that there was a fifth ashrama seeking liberation. And to do this, you were required to be a Brahmin, and you couldn't speak with women, it says in the Pashupata Sutras, and you had to follow various practices, various stages of practice. You had to live near a Shaiva temple, well, probably a Pashupata owned temple, and you had to bear the marks of a Shaiva ascetic. So you had to wear a linga around your neck, perhaps, and wear the three horizontal marks of Shiva on your body, on your forehead, and on your body. And you bathe in ashes three times a day. And you worship Shiva with mantra, with songs, and singing and dancing. And laughter. It says you worship Shiva with laughter. And you beg for food. So you're an ascetic living near a temple, begging for food, singing and dancing and laughing. And trying to develop virtues such as not stealing, celibacy, and non violence, says the Pashupata Sutras. And so that's the first stage of the Pashupata Vrata, the Pashupata vow. And then there's a second stage, which is abandoning external signs. So you leave the temple and you perform antisocial behaviour, it says. Now, why on earth do you do that? This is Pashupata 3, 12 to 17. To gain merit, you gain the good karma of other people, because if you behave as if you're lame or you abuse people, they'll abuse you back, and because they're abusing a holy man, a sannyasin, you'll get their good merit, and there'll be a leakage of the merit from them into you, so you'll get their good karma through through them abusing you. But that's the rationale in the text for gaining merit, 3:12-17, as you could read. So you roll on the ground laughing wildly, and you make lewd gestures to young women, and you shout abuse at people. It's a bit like builders on a building site.
Well, drugged people, aren't they?
Well, that's they probably are. Yeah.
They take drugs a lot, so they behave in this fashion.
Yes. Then they may have done in those days as well. But this was the second stage of the Pashupata thing, for gaining merit. And then after that stage, the third stage, is they're called sadhakas as well, the Pashupata ascetic withdraws to a private place, lives from alms, meditates on the syllable Om and on the five mantras of Shiva, which are from the five faces of Shiva, and then finally withdraws into a cremation ground, becomes a shmashanavasi, is a cremation ground dweller, vasin, one who dwells in a shmashana, cremation ground, and he lives on whatever's available there until he dies, reaching union with Shiva, and that's Rudra Sayujya, union Sayujya with Rudra, with Shiva, Rudra. And you've probably got a kind of a practice of ritual death, which is what you get in the Shaiva texts, a bit like the Jain tradition. You get the Shaiva yogis would become detached from the world and practice ritual death. They sort of starve themselves to death, really, in order to gain union with Shiva, extreme asceticism. So that was the prescribed practice of these three stages that the Pashupata ascetic would go through. There was also the great vow, the Mahavrata, of a group called the Lakula Pashupatas, and this was the great vow for killing a Brahmin, which entailed living outside of Vedic society. And in the laws of Manu, 1173, it says that if you kill a Brahmin, you have to live outside of Vedic society and carry the dead person's skull with you for 12 years, and that's your punishment, as it were, in the laws of Manu. Now these people, they adopt that vow, although they haven't killed any Brahmins, they adopt the vow, the Mahavrata, the great vow. And so they're putting themselves outside of the orthodox sphere, outside of orthodoxy. And it's a kind of a confrontation with orthodoxy.
So those people are also Brahmin.
Yeah.
They kill Brahmin. Brahmin kill Brahmin.
They don't actually kill a Brahmin, but in the laws of Manu, there's a ruling. If you kill a Brahmin, this is your punishment. You have to carry the dead person's skull for 12 years. And that's linked to the different myth of Shiva as well, who cut off his father-in-law's head with his thumbnail and carried his head probably for 12 years, and then the head fell off in one of the ghats at Varanasi. So there's a myth behind this as well, or there's an etiological myth, if you like.
So just metaphor.
That's a
is
metaphor.
That real?
Well, who knows? In the laws of Manu, it says that, but I mean, I think Manu's got a very vivid imagination. I mean, think he
but that's been like always there, like Brahmins have been so held so high in the social hierarchy, you know, that if you kill the Brahmin or the cow,
Yeah.
You have to actually donate a golden one.
Yeah.
Of the same weight, and you can't do that because you're so poor.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So this was the rule in Manu anyway. But these Lakulisha Pashupatas undertook this vow voluntarily.
But I just want to say it's punishment for everyone who killed Brahman. Or
according to laws of Manu, whether it happened, I don't know, I'm afraid. But it was
everyone, not for different classes.
I think it was everyone. You'd have to check, but I think it was everyone. If you killed a Brahman.
So basically that is so much internalized, basically this concept of Brahman. Like my servants, when they work for me also, they... like, and when I want to pay them, they don't want to take the payment only because I'm a Brahmin.
Oh.
So that is like a very, it is going on still, you know, and you really need to get that out of them, you know, and tell them that, you know, that no more exists, and that if I'm a Brahmin, it's okay, it's fine, I mean, we could arrange it some other way.
Right, right.
But
well, it's very deep, these things.
Yeah, it's very deep rooted.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the lot of Kulishas, they do that according to these. There's other texts, and there are other Pashupata texts as well. A related group of the Kalamukhas, the black-faced ones, in Karnataka from the 11th to 13th century. They too became very powerful, and they had royal patronage, and they were the forerunners of the contemporary Ogoris and so on. They were a monastic order, a bit like the Pashupatas. Lorenzen has written a book on these, the Kalamukhas and Kalpalikas. And finally, the Lingayats, who wrote, became a popular movement which were derived from the Kalamukhas. So it stopped being a purely ascetic movement and became a popular movement linked with bhakti and devotion. So you get lots of devotional poetry by various poets. Basava is said to be the founder of this Lingayat tradition. But
and this will be based on the household or...
on the householder tradition.
Household.
That's right. So it moves from the Kalamukhas, from a ascetic tradition, to a much more popular householder tradition, which still exists. And the Lingayats are called... They wear a linga around their neck.
Okay.
A Shivalinga. And there's some wonderful poetry. There's a book by Ramanujan called Speaking of Shiva, which is a translation of Lingayat poetry, which is very beautiful. I don't think it actually probably bears much relation to the original poetry, but it's a very wonderful English poetry. And there's one poet, Mahadevi Yakar, was a female ascetic who wrote this fantastic poetry, who was a naked ascetic, unusual in India, who wrote this poetry. Take these husbands who die and feed them to your kitchen fires. My only lord is, my only husband is the lord, white as jasmine, which is Shiva, form of Shiva. So she worships this lord, white as jasmine, who is her only husband. So it's very beautiful devotional poetry by these Lingayats, which is still recited to this day. There's another group that I haven't got down there, which I should have mentioned, was the Kalpalikas. It's not quite clear. I think that the Kalpalikas were part of the Ati Marga rather than part of the Mantra Marga. The Kalpalikas. A Kalpala is a skull. It's related, it's cognate with our word cup. So skulls are cups. It's like skull in Scandinavian languages means cup, doesn't it? Skull, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I think so. Swedish means skull. It's skull lager, isn't it? Skull lager.
Used to be bad, I think.
Skull, yes. Yeah, skull is a cup in Scandinavian languages, which is related to our word skull. And kapala is Sanskrit for skull, which is related to our word cup, so skulls and cups are connected up. So the Kalpalikas, they were called that because they had a skull. They had a skull begging bowl made of a skull. And they carried a danda, a stick, with a skull on top of it, skull top staff.
You said on top of skull?
They had a stick with a skull on top of it, and they carried that, and they had a skull begging bowl. and they were covered in ashes. The difference between the Kalpalikas and the Pashupatas is that the Pashupatas cover themselves in cow dung ash, whereas the Kalpalikas cover themselves in the ashes of cremation grounds. So they were polluting themselves.
And you said the other one is ash from where? This one is
the Kalpalikas use ash from the cremation ground, from Shmashana. The Pashupatas are supposed to use ash from cow dung. Cow dung.
What is cow dung?
cow excretions. Cow poo.
cow dung.
Yeah.
Which is then dried. burnt. So they cover themselves in ashes. It's very pure. It's very purifying for the Pashupata. But because when you're a Shmashana Vasi, you probably cover yourself in cremation ground ash as well. But anyway,
is the burning of cow dung a normal practice, or would it?
Yeah, normal practice.
Be, yeah, okay.
Yeah, yeah.
It's very
normal.
You find it everywhere.
Yeah, you just dry these.
But it's readily accessible.
They make actually in the villages that's the main fuel.
The main fuel, yeah. Yeah. So you put them on the sides
and
of the house.
And the huts are also plastered with that only, with mud and cow dung.
Yeah. So it's just very distinctive smell. So that's anyway, that's the Ati Marga, the higher path, now, which was mainly a path of ascetics. But the Lingayats, which historically develop out of that Ati Marga, are a householder tradition. Which gets linked up with lots of bhakti and devotional poetry to Shiva. Now, on the other hand, the Mantra Marga, so you've got these two distinct groups, if you like, the Ati Marga and the Mantra Marga. The Mantra Marga, which is the path of mantras, believes in an alternative revelation to the Vedas, and this revelation is known as the Tantra, the Tantras, and also called the Agamas.
So is that alternative?
Yeah, because these tantras regarded themselves as higher than the Vedas, as fulfillments of the Veda. And they were composed in Sanskrit between the 8th and 11th centuries. And they claim to be revelation. And some accept the Veda, but others reject the Veda. But all claim to supersede the Veda. They're all going beyond the Veda. And they're composed in a number of traditions. In the Vaishnava traditions, what are they called? Pancharatra texts. The Shakta and Shaiva traditions have tantras. There are also a tradition to the sun, Saura tantras, which are completely lost. There are no records, there are no Saura tantras anymore. And the Garuda tantras, they're all gone too. They're about snake bites. And the Bauda tantras, of course, the Buddhist tantras are still there. And the Jain tantras, we still have the Jain tantras. But the Garuda and the Saura have disappeared. So
do we have a Garuda Puran?
It's a Garuda Purana, but there's no Garuda Tantras anymore. They're all lost to history. And what are their concerns with these texts? They're concerned with practice, sadhana. And the person who performs the practice, the sadhana, is a sadhaka. And that involves ritual, yoga, initiation from a master. And some tantras are about building temples, and there's lots of architecture in some of them. And also concerned with daily rites, naimittika karma, nitya karma, occasional rites, naimittika karma, and rites for a desired object, kamya karma. So if you want to be wealthy, you perform rituals to get that. If you want your enemies killed. So there's magical dimensions to some of these texts as well. Now, it became all pervasive. Medieval Hinduism is tantric Hinduism. It becomes all pervasive, particularly in royal courts. The kings are very, very attracted by the tantric traditions. And it dominates Southeast Asia as well. So the Khmer kings imported Brahmins in from India, tantric Brahmins in from India, Shaiva Brahmins, to perform their royal consecrations. And that tradition is in an attenuated form, still goes on in Thailand today, where the king is consecrated by the Brahmins, by the Brahmin priests. So Yeah, they've got, and they're still. I mean, in Kerala, for example, contemporary Kerala, normative Hinduism, tantric Hinduism is normative Hinduism in Kerala. It's just ordinary, straightforward Hinduism, temple Hinduism. It's called tantric. So the priests are called tantris. Who do the pujas to deities. So it's a kind of externalized, exoteric in tantric Hinduism in Kerala, which is still left over from the medieval period. These texts were said to be composed of four feet, jnana, yoga, ritual, and behaviour, charya. Now that's it's a bit of a false construction matter. Some of them, later tantras do follow that pattern, but not all of them do. And the purpose, what's the purpose of these texts? They say the purpose is liberation and pleasure, bhoga, in higher worlds. Bhukti. Bhoga is moksha, but pleasure is liberation. They're concerned with pleasure and liberation in higher worlds, not this world, other heavens and so on. They're concerned with cultivating magical powers, siddhi, and they're concerned with controlled possession. So you get power through the goddess entering you, Arvesha Maam, enter me, and she enters you, and you take control of her. To get power. And there was a lot of royal patronage of these tantric groups. So the Natra Tantra, for example, was about 10th or 11th century Shaiva Tantra, the Eye Tantra, the form of Shiva in the eye, the Natra, Natra, Lord of the Eye. And that was adopted by the royal kings in Kashmir as a key text. And the Purohita, the royal priest, was versed in the Natra Tantra and taught the Natra Tantra to the king. And that tantra contains a lot of material about subtle body. Is a very esoteric text in many ways, but it was nevertheless was adopted by royalty. Now these tantras are the revelation of the Shaiva tradition. You also get the tantras as a revelation of some tantric Buddhism and also the Vaishnava tradition, the Pancharatra. But the Shaiva tantras are the prototype. They're the earliest and they're the prototype, which form the basis of the Vaishnava tantras. Well, the Vaishnava tantras are modelled on the Shaiva ones, probably, and the Buddhist tantras are probably modelled on the Shaiva ones. It's particularly the Anuttara Yoga tantras, the highest yoga tantras in Buddhism, are copies of the Shaiva texts. So they scrub out the word Vairochana and put the word they scrub up Maheshvara and put Vairochana or something like that, or some Buddhist deity, some Buddhist Buddha. Now within the tantric traditions, there's one terribly important group called the Shaiva Siddhanta, which is the fundamental Shaiva system. It's a bit like if the relationship between the more esoteric kinds of Shaivism and Shaivism. It's a bit like the relation between Mahayana Buddhism and Tibetan Buddhism. Tibetan Buddhism assumes Mahayana Buddhism. So the esoteric Shaiva traditions assume the Shaiva Siddhanta. So it's the fundamental Shaiva system. It's still in existence in South India today, particularly at Chidambaram. The sky of the town of the sky of consciousness, Chidambaram. Now there are various theologians, important medieval theologians in this school, Sadyajyoti, Bhattanarayana Kanta, and his son Ramakanta, whose dates are 950 to about 1000 CE in Kashmir. Terribly important tradition in Kashmir, where it's based on ritual and develops a strong commentarial tradition, philosophical tradition. So they argue against the Buddhists and they argue against the Vaishnavas and they argue against the Mimamsakas and also the non-dual Shaivas. And it spreads to the south when it gets I'm trying to think of a good word. What's a good word for infected or contaminated? Influenced, something like that. Pervaded by Tamil Bhakti devotionalism. So it becomes a Tamil tradition, but nevertheless maintains its Sanskritic origins. And there's several important figures here. There's Soma Shambhu, who was an abbot of a monastery, a mata, in the 11th century in South India. And there's an important figure called Bhojadeva, who was a king, King Bhoja, Bhoja Raja or Bhojadeva, who wrote an important text on the Shaiva Siddhanta, the Tattva Prakasha, the illumination of the reality, or the categories in the 11th century. And what are the fundamental doctrines? The fundamental doctrines, it's theistic and it's dualistic, and there's five acts. Shiva has five acts. He creates the universe, he maintains the universe, and he destroys the universe. And he has two further acts. He reveals himself and he conceals himself from his devotees. And the Shiva Drishti says, as a king dresses up as an infantry soldier and walks amongst his troops, so Shiva disguises his true nature as the universe and the world and hides himself from himself, becomes manifest as the universe. So that's his five acts. And why does he do that? Two reasons. One is krida, play, and the second reason is for the liberation of souls. He creates the universe so that souls can be liberated. And you think, well, if he didn't create the universe, they wouldn't need to be liberated in the first place, but then... anyway, that's why he does it. And there are three categories, which are eternal ontological categories. The self, the Lord, and matter. A bit like the Samkhya system, only with an addition of the Lord. So it's really Samkhya plus God. And the creation is in two stages. There's a pure creation and an impure creation. The pure creation involves various levels of reality called tattvas, which are manifestations of Shiva. And then one of his regents, Ananta, there are a group of beings called Vidyeshwaras, the lords of the Vidya, lords of wisdom, create the lower universe. And Ananta is the big god who creates the lower universe. Out of a substance or a drop called Bindu. Bindu or Dravya. Dravya is substance. Bindu means drop.
Drop.
Drop. Yeah, drop.
Drop.
Yeah. Like a bindi. Bindu. Substance. Drop. And the universe, the lower universe, evolves out of Bindu. So... on the other side of the second sheet, have you got a list of 36 Shaiva tattvas?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Good. Then, on the left, you've got these are the Shaiva Siddhanta categories of the universe. I don't think I'll go through the whole lot, but you'll see from 12 to 36, Purusha and Prakriti. Now, we recognize those from Samkhya, so it's the Samkhya tattvas plus 11 Shaiva ones. Now, their creation is divided into the pure, the mixed, and the impure. Above the dotted line, you've got these five manifestations of Shiva, and they're called the pure creation, the pure creation. And then you've got the level of Maya, which is the impure creation underneath that. Now, Bindu exists at the level of Maya. It's a subtle form of Maya. It's actually called Mahamaya, the great Maya, Bindu, the drop. And from that drop, all these other evolutes emerge. So at that level of the universe, you've got these three impurities of individuality, action, and illusion operative that covers the soul, that controls the coverings over the soul. It's a terribly complex system. And the complexity comes because you've got lots of different cosmological systems being brought together, and the Shaiva Siddhanta attempts to integrate all these different systems with Samkhya, with the Shaiva systems, and lots of other things. So it looks a bit of a mess, but they actually do it in a coherent way. I won't go into it all now because we don't really have time. Now, corresponding to these tattvas, these levels of the universe, you have different kinds of beings who experience different kinds of experience. So, on the right-hand side, you've got these different kinds of experience. So at the level of Sadashiva, who is the white five-armed form of Shiva, who the Shaiva Siddhanta worship, is their object of worship. you get beings called Mantra Maheshwaras or Vidyeshwaras. Now, at the level of Sadashiva, the Sadashiva Tattva, you've got these eight beings called Vidyeshwaras, and one of them, called Ananta, is the regent, if you like, who creates the lower universe. And we have icons and images to Ananta. Now, below them, you've got the Mantreshwaras, the laws of mantra, and below them, you've got the mantras, who are, again, beings. It's interesting that you've got mantras, of course, sound forms, but they're also gods. And also higher beings that exist at this higher level of the universe. And then below then you've got these other kinds of beings that exist, vijnana kalas, those who are particularized by consciousness, those the palaya kalas, those whose power is disillusion, so that when they die they go up to the level of maya and wait there for a few million years before they're reborn again, and they have different impurities. And then finally, the Sakala beings, which have all three impurities, individuality, action, and delusion. So we're Sakala beings, along with frogs and mosquitoes and camels. We're all Sakala beings. And we're covered by these coverings, these powers of Kala, particular agency, limited knowledge, passion, time. Time keeps us bound. Niyati, fate or constraint. So all of these keep the Sakala being bound in the universe. So liberation comes then through getting rid of all that, through becoming, rising, getting beyond Maya and going beyond Bindu. And it occurs through grace, through the grace of the Lord. Anugraha or Prasada. And initiation, you get the grace of the Lord at initiation and through ritual effort as well. So Shiva enters the Guru's body, sorry, there's an apostrophe missing there, during initiation. So Soma Shambhu wrote a ritual manual, a very famous ritual manual called the Soma Shambhu Padati, which is four volumes, translated into French by Helen Brunner, which has been a breakthrough in the scholarship of Shaivism, the translation of this fundamental ritual text. And in there she describes what these Shaivas do, and they still do to this day. So you get initiated, you get a new name, a Diksha name, and you're blindfolded as an initiated. You go into the mandala, which is on the floor, mandala, circular mandala, square mandala, and you're blindfolded, and you take a flower and you cast the flower into the mandala. Where it lands, the section of the mandala in which it lands, that determines your initiatory name and your group of deities who you worship thereafter. And then you sleep on the mandala and you report your dreams to the guru in the morning, who interprets your dreams for you. And that's the initiation. I don't think it involved branding. The Pancharatra involved branding with an iron, hot iron, but the Shaivas I don't think involved branding. But you have to wear the marks of your initiation. And so you get initiated, Diksha, and there's different levels of initiation that Bruno Lachaud explains that are described by Soma Shambhu. There's the normative initiation. And then there's the Nirvana Diksha, the liberating initiation. So there are two stages of this process. The first is where you get initiated, you get allowed to read the text of the tradition, the Karmika Agama, the tantras of that tradition. You're allowed to read them or hear them. And then followed by that is the Nirvana Diksha, the liberating initiation, which guarantees you liberation within several lifetimes, or perhaps even in this lifetime. So that at death, you don't have to be reborn. So you follow your ritual actions in this life, and then at death you get liberated through the grace of Shiva, through having been initiated. And your acharya, your teacher, takes on your sins, takes on your karma. And this is followed by two other further possibilities, Abhisheka, which is the consecration, in which you become a teacher in the tradition, you become a teacher in the tradition. Or there's a further initiation called the sadhaka. I'm getting confused. No, there are two initiations. There's two initiations, samaya and the diksha, and then there's two further consecrations after that, the sadhaka and the acharya. The sadhaka consecration allows you to become a teacher. Allows you to become a yogi who seeks power in higher worlds, and the acharya initiation allows you to become a teacher in the tradition. Sorry, I was getting confused.
So, this Vishaka, okay, there's a one in the middle. Then, how about the third one?
There's two kinds of dikshas, two initiations, the Samaya and the Nirvana, and then there's two kinds of Abhishekas, the Sadhaka and the Acharya.
Two kinds of
And different kinds of people pursue these. Those who desire liberation, the Mumukshu, follow the Acharya Abhisheka, and those who desire pleasure in higher worlds, the Bhubukshu, follow the Sadhaka path. So the Sadhaka is a Bhubukshu, one who desires liberation, the one who desires pleasure. And these traditions were closed to women, and the women could participate in the traditions vicariously through their husbands. So the husband performed these rites, and that had brought their wives with them. These were householder traditions, and still are householder traditions. And you have daily rites, three at dawn, midday, and dusk. And these are terribly complex rituals that involve the purification of the body, the bhuta-shuddhi, the elements in the body, which involve symbolically destroying the body, so it's burned up from the toe of the right foot until it's a pile of ashes, and then it's washed away in your imagination by a flood of mantras. And then you reconstruct your body as a divine body, divya deha, through mantras, putting mantras upon your body, nyasa. And then you worship your deity within, in your imagination, in visualization, the antara yaga, followed by worshipping your the linga outside of your body in an icon, the bahira yaga. And that will also be followed by a puja into the fire. So you do that three times a day, dawn, midday, and dusk, a terribly time-consuming rite. And the Shaivas, Orthodox, if you're an Orthodox Shaiva, you still might do that, rather than South India today in Chidambaram.
We usually do the Rudrabhishek, which takes 5 hours.
I think these, in the Soma Shambhu, it took two or three days, these rites. But I think they're shorter now. There's another book by Richard Davis called Worshipping Shiva in an Oscillating Universe. And that's really a sort of English description of Bruno Lachaud's exposition. And that's very good, so I encourage you to read that on this material. I'm going to stop because the Lord Siddhartha Kashyapa and we don't have time for, but I think I'll carry on with that next time and finish that off. Any questions or points?
You mentioned in the initiation, branding something.
Oh, that was a pancharatra. They would brand you, brand your arm. A brand is a like a poker, metal with a hot thing, like they do to cows in America. You'd have a symbol of your branding.
Like a tattoo.
Hot, something hot. Burning into your skin.
Sir, the contrast is that in the Hazara tradition, the maximum Shiva worship or the Ling worship is done by the women only.
Which one?
Though I'm a Vaishnava Brahmin, but then the families, basically, the Shiva temples are there aren't any men,
in the Shiva temple.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
It's
yeah.
always the ladies, especially on the one days and Shivratri and all that.
They all go.
Loads of, I mean, it's just the ladies who worship the lady.
Right, but it's the priest is a guy.
Yeah, priest yeah. has to be.
Yeah, yeah, priest has
and
to be.
In some tradition, like the unmarried or the married also, women cannot worship Hanuman, but in Rajasthan they do.
Ah, yes. It's always exceptions.
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if there is a written rule so which says that we the ladies are not allowed to, or is it just an inference drawn?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard that about Hanuman being...
They don't the worshipper doesn't touch us. He's a male.
Mm.
I mean, like even if he's giving us the prasad, he just like drop it, you know, there, and we need to pick it up. He
right.
actually does not touch the woman.
Yeah, yeah.
But
so
like,
rules of ritual purity are very high, and they are amongst the Shaiva Siddhantins. The rules of ritual purity are very high, very strict.
Mm.
But there's still Chidambaram is a Shaiva centre, and all these practices still carry on.
Yeah, with the Nambudri Brahmins of Kerala.
And indeed the Nambudris of Kerala. Well, they're slightly different there, but indeed they carry on there. So, we'll look at the non-Siddhantika Shaivism next time. And also conflate it with whatever the other thing we're going to do.
Mm-hmm.